Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. So in this episode, I will be covering the 9/11 conspiracies, kind of drilling down a little bit, looking at the conspiracies themselves and the evolution of the conspiracies, because what was unique about and what is unique about the 9/11 conspiracies is that it seemed to morph from very simple, basic type conspiracies into more and more elaborate conspiracies. So I'd like to start with shortly after the attacks, within the first couple years, the conspiracy actually was more based, in this period of time, was more based on people just asking the obvious questions. Who did it? Why did they do it? Could it have been prevented? And why? Why did this actually occur? And these are fairly legitimate, and these were fairly legitimate questions. You know, who was responsible? And as the evidence began to filter out, and this all started really with news reports and so on, and as new pieces began to emerge, when we started discovering that this was not a homegrown or a, you know, random events, this was an actual orchestrated by a handful of Middle Eastern, primarily Saudi Arabian, Islamic fundamentalists who decided, or as part of a major effort to conduct an attack against the United States. We began to learn that these young men was able to gain access to the United States through standard visa procedures and were gaining an education here in the States, learning to fly airplanes and so on. And soon it began to build and build. And as it became more evident that these terrorists were working through the Al-Qaeda network, and which is, of course, was being run by Osama bin Laden. And as the questions were being answered, of course, new questions cropped up. Why weren't these guys checked? And of course, beginning to poke into their lives and what they were and who they were. And a picture began to emerge that didn't quite fit what Americans stereotype as Islamic extremists. Muhammad Atta, many of the, and all his other associates shaved their beards, drank alcohol, hung out in strip joints. And again, this kind of the American stereotype of Middle Eastern are these bearded guys in turbans who ride on camels and who are unintelligent, whatever, you know, this basics, you know, that they're ignorant peasant types, not realizing these were intelligent, well-educated, very devout, religious types. And the job that were chosen to perform was basically a strike against the West, part of the jihad, and once they died, all their sins on earth were forgiven, and they would be given their whatever promises they're given as part of their afterlife. So these young men. These 19 young men, mostly Saudi Arabian, but the ringleader of the hijackers, Muhammad Atta, was Egyptian, and there were some from Yemen, so on. And this mission they undertook was certainly it's a very audacious operation. So going back in this period between the attacks and the 9/11 commission, many of the conspiracies questioned the ability of these guys to undertake this attack, up to a point where even one of the terrorists, Hani Hanjour, was even accused of being a extremely poor pilot. the only problem here with this argument that these were amateurs and they were unable, you know, couldn't possibly have piloted these planes making maneuvers that they did, was that these were not professional pilots. And in Hani Hanjour's case, in his student files, it was mentioned that he was a poor pilot. Now, unfortunately, again, with the way conspiracies tend to work, certain facts got ignored. Apparently, the three toughest parts about flying an airplane is takeoff, landing, and dealing with weather. But in the case of all these hijackings on 9/11, the planes were already in the air. They were already fairly unstable flight plans, clear weather. And of course, these guys had the pilots, Atta and Hanjour especially, have had some flight training, so they understood how the airplanes operated. So this is kind of the anomalies that were popping up. And certainly the questions about what was going on started to build. And this would kind of build along the lines of things like the building collapses. Like I stated in my last podcast, Richard Gage of the American Architects for 9/11 Truth thought it was very tough for an airplane crashing into these buildings to cause the type of damage they caused and these ultimate collapses. But again, if I were to press Gage on it, on the question, I would probably say, well, I'm assuming that you're under the impression that these buildings were built to certain specifications, but we were not talking about 1969 specifications. We're talking what you would put this building together in 2001. At the time, the World Trade Center was built. The largest airplane was a 707, which is a smaller airplane than the 767s and the 757s that were flown into these buildings. And certainly the Pentagon, built in the late 40s or early 40s, was certainly not designed or even probably not even contemplated having a 757 or a 767 flown into them. But these conspiracies continued. There was most of it focused on the hijackers themselves. How did they come up with so much information? There were questions about flight recorders. And in the Pentagon case, why were there no films, no photographs of engine or airplane parts? But again, this was in a sense, an anomaly hunt where the conspiracy types were picking out photos that didn't show wreckage. Whereas you do any type of search on the internet on the Pentagon 9/11 crash, you will find plenty of photos with airplane debris scattered all over that part of the building that was hit. And shortly afterwards, film was released. Because again, part of the problem was that we're not only dealing with people wanting answers, but this was in the midst of a criminal investigation, trying to find out if there were more people involved, what assistance they may have had, any money that may have been spent or provided through Al Qaeda network. Did Bin Laden finance this, or how, tracing the money down to find other co-conspirators. So a lot of information wasn't being released, so the conspiracy theorists filled in the blanks. And eventually the level of these conspiracies began to grow. A professor from Windsor University in Ontario, Canada, set forth this idea that the planes were routed to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the passengers offloaded and loaded onto Flight 93. Drones were sent to attack the buildings, and 93 was intentionally shot down by a A-10 attack plane painted white so that it would not be recognized, and all the witnesses died in Pennsylvania. Again, and this was all based on fuzzy photographs. And of course, this professor, who apparently was a computer science professor, so probably not his expertise in looking at aircraft, his expertise would have been computer programming. So Of course, as these conspiracies began to grow, eventually the 9/11 Commission finally released its report and did a fairly decent job. Of course, again, we're talking about the government. Government reports only deal with the evidence at hand, and there were questions about, and it came out during the 9/11, as part of the 9/11 Commission's investigation, discovered that the various departments, very much like the Kennedy assassination in that story, where these departments did not share information. But in a weird way, they were supposed to, there was information that was supposed to be shared that didn't happen. This is actually after the first a bombing attempt on the World Trade Center in 1983. The decision was to try to integrate all this information, the NSA, FBI, CIA, State Department, and any other department that was collecting information to share with everybody. But apparently this didn't really happen. It was oddly enough an oversaturation of information, that it was almost like trying to find a needle in a needle stack. So when 9/11 rolls around, and those who should have been flagged, especially Atta, Hanjour, a few others, probably were flagged, but that information was never identified as potential threats. Plus the fact that, again, in this country, before 9/11, you did need some fairly serious evidence to undertake an investigation and possible deportation of these suspects. So in the aftermath of the 9/11 Commission, the United States basically, about the only kind word to say, is went insane. The 9/11 Commission identified a few things, and of course made some other discoveries, and had released it and basically tied the hijackers to players like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Osama bin Laden. So it was clear this was an Al-Qaeda operation. It was executed, funded through Al-Qaeda. But other revelations came out of the 9/11 Commission, which seems to get glossed over. But as I'm reading it, it was made well aware that the United States had many occasions to take out bin Laden, but chose not to because of various bureaucratic, not necessarily, it sounded more like infighting amongst the different departments, and the more the concern of the impression after the fact. The United States had tried to enlist Afghani soldiers, operating groups, especially the Northern Alliance. But again, officials within the State Department and apparently the CIA felt that these were unreliable and could make a bigger mess than what was really required. And there was the concern that it would be linked back to the United States. Other type of attempts, such as cruise missile strikes against places where bin Laden was supposed to be at, were contemplated and almost executed. But again, it was snafu'd by either military or State Department officials. So really, the 9/11 Commission really painted a very dismal record for the government. And of course, this shouldn't be unexpected. We have seen through the Kennedy investigations, we will see it when I talk about the TWA 800 conspiracy. We will see this throughout the latter half of the 20th century, that the United States had failed on so many different levels by so many people. So, with bin Laden being the primary target, this prompted the U.S. to begin its operations to deal with bin Laden and hit any government that will harbor bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda terrorist group. And this came in the form of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Sheikh Omar, who was the leader of the Taliban and basically the ruler of Afghanistan, had decided to support bin Laden and denied the United States access to arresting bin Laden, which prompted the Afghan war that has now been going on for over 10 years. And as this was going on, other issues within the Middle East, especially Iraq, began to fester. And oddly enough, a second war would break out with the United States attacking Iraq, which of course fueled an already burgeoning conspiracy mill here in the United States and around the world. Many of these conspiracy theorists were convinced that the 9/11, and this is when the belief that 9/11 was part of a false flag operation to get us and get the American people behind major wars in the Middle East. This has been pressed forward by many of the more radical of the conspiracy theorists, James Fetzer, G. Edward Griffin, and of course mimicked by Alex Jones, Jeff Renz, even getting to a point where even guys like Glenn Beck began to spew these more advanced conspiracy concepts that this was all staged, or at least the terrorists may have been Middle Eastern, but they had been trained here in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, with that came the idea that these buildings may have been part of a controlled demolition. Again, to maximize effect, because again, the main issue had been that the fires that had broke out after the planes crashed could not have possibly melted steel, thus causing these collapses. It had to be done by a controlled demolition. Even finding one of the fire chiefs saying that it looked as if it was a controlled demolition. And of course, all these scientists or what have you had began to press forward this idea of kerosene, which is basically kerosene, only burns at 750 degrees. You need over 2,000 degrees to melt steel. But this had been kind of debunked a little bit by the National Institute the National Institute of Standards and Technology, where the metal in the building didn't need to melt, it softened in these fires. But I even did some extra research into this, and there is an interesting possibility. Even though kerosene, again, jet fuel is basically a pure kerosene, it does burn. If you were to make a puddle and throw a match in it, I don't recommend doing that. But if you were to do something like that and you spill some kerosene, you accidentally drop a match or something like into it, it'll burn. That's roughly about 750 degrees. But if you were to apply oxygen and create a chimney effect within the building, which apparently, since these whole floors were compromised and large openings, plus you're high up, a lot of wind, kerosene fires can actually reach over 3,000 degrees. So it is quite possible that these kerosene fires melted the steel. But more than likely, the heat that was applied, and we're not just talking kerosene from jet fuel, but we are also talking paper, desks, plastics, carpeting, the drywall coatings and the paper that makes up drywall. All are combustibles, could also generate enough heat to cause this buckling. Plus the fact that once you start moving steel that was designed to create a rigid structure. That is, when a structure is built, each component is, they don't just randomly throw steel up to make a building. Each piece of steel has an important role to play in the creation of that structure. You take away one or two members, the design, the basic design parameters are now changing. You start melting steel. You start taking away internal structure, the floor structures. You start compromising columns. You've changed all these dynamics that eventually, if you don't deal with the fires quickly, and based on the timeline, these fires had been burning for almost 2 hours before the buildings began to collapse. Most of the time, these buildings may not even be prepared to burn for an hour. So, of course, again, we're dealing with these anomalies. But of course, in these cases, no one basically carried the equations beyond what was, it only burns at 750 degrees. They didn't carry it any further and say, well, what about chimney effect? What about, additional burning material? What could have been, other factors that may play into it? Just claiming that, making the claim that because the outer skin was damaged, a building, the burning kerosene would not bring down the building is actually a true statement, but the conspiracy theorists don't want to carry it on and say, well, there's other fires burning, other floors were on fire, et cetera, et cetera. And this brings us to the loose change, which, really all loose change is a listing of the various anomalies that were observed on that day. Everything from the pilots, the airplanes, there was in some versions of loose change. Remember that we're dealing with four revisions of this documentary loose change. In some cases, they had, mentioned that these airplanes were drones. They had mentioned, again, the fires, the appearance of controlled demolition, which was actually, as the building was collapsing, compressed air building up, forced puffs of smoke as the pressure built up, blew out windows, blew out panels, making it look like little puffs of smoke as if they were mini explosions. Oh, this was actually air rushing out of the building as these cards, basically each floor started collapsing. Then you had, in the case of the Pentagon, a quote unquote animation shows the airplane plowing through lampposts and so on that should have shredded the airplane before it hit building. Well, there's a slight problem here. Light posts are designed to fall over when they're hit. Again, this is a safety feature. Cars that hit light poles, the idea is to get the pole to break and fall away from the car so you don't kill anybody in the car. And of course, the photos actually support this. You'll see the light posts knocked over. Then there was the Flight 93 crash in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And the coroner and his comment, there's nobody here. I believe the actual comment was, he said there's nobody here, but they cut him off. It says, because everyone's dead. The airplane actually, again, and this is a very common, it was actually a fairly common, phenomenon, I guess. Airplanes crashing and would literally bury themselves in the ground. Not too long ago, during a construction in London, a Spitfire warplane from the Second World War was found under a street because where it crashed had literally buried itself into the street. And it wasn't until this construction, I believe it was some construction for a subway, where they actually discovered this plane with the pilot still intact inside the plane. So this is, again, nothing out of the ordinary. But of course, with the conspiracy types, this was anomalies. These were anomalies and they needed to be explained. And that's what happened with Popular Mechanics and its analysis of the 9/11 myths, and actually wrote a series of articles, a whole section in the Popular Mechanics, literally debunking every aspect of the 9/11 conspiracy. So in the March 2005 issue of Popular Mechanics, the article 9/11 Debunking the Myths went through all the known conspiracies surrounding 9/11 and thoroughly debunked each and every one. In a kind of a strange way, and of course, again, there are conspiracy theorists have these wonderful little outs that they've created for themselves, but many of the conspiracies died that day with that article, other than the few diehards like Jason Burmes Jason Burmes and Corey Rowe, Jason Burmes and Corey Rowe of the Loose Change movies still hung on to their particular conspiracies. Richard Gage also questioned the validity of the Popular Mechanics article, and few of the others, like James Fetzer. Plus, on top of it, Alex Jones would also espouse the questionable article. But for most of the conspiracies had kind of died on that day. But as far as Roe, Avery, Fetzer, Jones, the Popular Mechanics article was part of a government plot to discredit the events and basically was part of the became part of the conspiracy, at least in their minds. But for others, they began to the conspiracy still believing the conspiracy exists, but most of their evidence has now been destroyed. Turned to Building 7. And trying to find out why that building, since it was not hit by a airplane, why it managed to collapse. And this is where we start getting into the more esoteric aspects of the 9/11 conspiracy, where people were being accused of committing certain criminal acts. The operator of the World Trade Center, Larry Silverstein, made a comment to the fire marshal at the time in reference to Building 7, and told the fire marshal to pull it, which of course has become as part of the conspiracy that this was to tell them to pull the building down, let the building come down. The reality was that Silverstein, who saw the devastation, who saw the loss of lives, told the fire marshal, let it burn, let it go. We don't need to lose any more lives. Pulled them out. Because Silverstein also has been accused, and this is, of course, generally refer to as irrelevant evidence. Silverstein had purchased the rights and was going to operate the buildings and had finally signed the papers in June of 2001. And of course had to insure these buildings. And the buildings were actually, the insurance policies went into effect in August of 2001. And of course a month later, the buildings collapse. Now, I guess to the savvy conspiracy type, this sounds awful lot like insurance fraud. So Silverstein convinced a bunch of Arabs, perhaps maybe somehow convincing the government to send Arabs to hijack a bunch of airplanes and crash them into the building. But the thing is, and quite frankly, is as far as I'm concerned, when you buy something big, something where you've borrowed money, like for a car, a house, a building, what have you, you're going to have to buy insurance because bad things happen to buildings. Buildings catch on fire. Cars run into other cars. Cars run into houses, into trees. People buy insurance. And in most cases, dealing with insurance, and I'm sure if you have ever bought a car, bought a house, if you rent, you probably have or considered renter's insurance, all that kind of stuff. This is to cover any damages that may happen. If the building burns down, if your house burns down, the bank wants you to rebuild and they want the house insured at least to the value of the loan that you have taken out. So Silverstein had to get the $1 billion insurance policy for the World Trade Center. And there's nothing magical to that. When you have, and again, many of the conspiracy types have pointed to Silverstein hiring an ex-FBI director as the head of the security for the building. Again, this is all, again, lends to the possibility that the government had used this guy to allow the spooks or whatever to get into the buildings to rig it for controlled demolitions. Now, again, this guy had retired from the FBI and needed a job. If you were running a large operation like the World Trade Center, because there were more than three buildings. I mean, there was basically nine buildings associated with the World Trade Center, including the Twin Towers, a couple hotels. There were World Trade Center 7, which was a being used by the city of New York as it was actually to be used as a command center for a disaster such as the attack on the World Trade Center. You just don't want to hire somebody off the street to manage security for these buildings. These buildings house businesses. Now, some of them may have money. in safes or whatever. They might be banks or whatever within there, but there is also, normal office buildings and of course security for the, the records and so on. There's always going to be security in these buildings. So putting someone who has terrorist experience in charge of your security makes perfect sense. So I don't see anything out of the ordinary. But of course, many of these, irrelevant, aspects. I mean, it even goes as far as Henry Kissinger may have been involved because he was working a deal with UNICAL, the Union Oil of California, about building a pipeline across Afghanistan in the 60s. What relevance does that have? So that's why I'm actually going to go into these more in the next podcast, but this seems to be the next step in the evolution. Having lost their basic arguments, now had to switch to Building 7, again claiming that it was taken down with controlled demolitions, the discovery of this stuff called nanothermite. Now, I'm not exactly 100% sure what nanothermite really is, if it really exists, if this is just a manifestation of somebody's imagination, or is this some experimental material? This is not something, nanotechnology has not really reached the level of sophistication where we're just beginning to tap its resources. But when we usually refer to nanotechnology, this is usually carbon-based structures, not thermite, which is a iron, I think it's iron, aluminum, but there's this thing about nanothermite, and everything I've read about it makes no sense because it's thermite. It's the same basic stuff that welders use. And I know electricians use it quite a bit to create grounding systems. That's how they weld their welding copper grounding loops to ground rods and attaching that grounding loop to structural steel. They'll use basically it's a thermite compound that you use a mold. You set this stuff off. The iron melts because it's blended in with the aluminum and whatever the other chemicals are. So when it reacts, those chemicals spew out, leaving behind this iron, basically it looks like solder. When you look at it, it looks like solder, but it's actually, you've melted the copper to the steel or any other copper that's there, and you've made literally a permanent connection. And again, I would, assume that since this is fairly common material, in a city that is always under construction, they'll use thermite to do these special welds. I would not be surprised to see the whole city covered with a fine layer of this material, because apparently this was discovered a few years after the fact. So, and at least this, what they're calling the residue from the nanothermite, but it ended up being, actually just, toner particles, but of course that doesn't stop the conspiracy theorist. So what we're seeing today is really kind of the death throes of this conspiracy. Certainly there's a lot, still some questions out there, and actually I'll probably try to talk a little bit more. I want to get into more of the details of some of the good questions, the not so good questions, and then the irrelevant questions in the next, in my next podcast.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Now, I have no real news to report on, but I do have an announcement on February 1st. That's going to be a Saturday at noon Central Time, United States. I am going to record this podcast live on a YouTube hangout with the Irreverent Skeptics. So in the show notes, I will have links to the actual hangout. If you follow me on Google+, I should have that, you should have already gotten an invite to look in on on it. Also, I'm going to Saturday, I'll probably do some cross posting into Twitter and the Facebook page if you follow me there. So, it's going to be, I'm going to do a live recording. It'll be with the, this group I'm with, the Reverend Skeptics. We do a Saturday hangout on Google, and then we record it, and we're actually putting it together as a podcast. Hopefully soon we'll get our act together and get the first episodes up on that. But you can watch us live. You can ask questions. I highly encourage you to check it out, and feel free to, if you got questions, I'll be talking about the 9/11 conspiracies, drilling more into the individual claims and some of the more, and even the more esoteric conspiracies that have come out of it. And then I haven't really decided if I'm going to do conclusions at the end of this show, or if it runs long, split it into two shows, and then a final show as a kind of a conclusion and a wrap-up show. So I hope you would join me on February 1st. Again, there'll be links on my webpage, mikebowler.com. There'll be, if you're following me on Google, you should already have gotten the invite. I'll hopefully be posting it to the Facebook and my Twitter feed. So thank you. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebowler.com. That's MikeBohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebowler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebowler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Zarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.